saved this as a PDF, and then I realized that when you do it as a PDF, you don't get the animations in there. So I'm sorry, there won't be any animations, but it should be fine. So this presentation is based on work that I've done on almost a semi-formal or informal basis with a couple different efforts in the city of Detroit. And the reason why I italicized two promising efforts in the early stages here is because one of the things I want to sort of highlight and talk about is the gap between promise, what we promise, and what we deliver, and how that emerges in these different projects. So the two photographs here are from the two the areas where the two different projects were based. So this is the outline of my presentation, and this is just as much for my benefit as it is for yours, because this helps me to sort of stay on track. I am a sociologist, so I offer that as a disclaimer, not an excuse. So I may tend to talk about some questions that are theoretical or try and widen the scope what we're looking at, you know, in these specific projects. So I'm going to start with a kind of a background of the two different sites that were targeted in the efforts that I'm going to discuss, and the organizations that were involved. And I'm also going to compare two paradigms which I feel were at work or could be at work, even though these were not sort of consciously invoked or in the process or in the discussion of these two efforts, at least not that I heard. So I'm going to talk about these theoretical paradigms and how they might apply in these cases. And in terms of sources and methods, I'm just going to say, do this part right now, because I don't have a separate slide on this. A lot of what you're going to see in the presentation is based on secondary data and documents that I had access to, some of which were provided to me by the different organizations. Also, I was a participant observer to a greater or lesser extent in both projects. I'm on the leadership task force for the Recovery Park project, which I'll be talking about, and I've also been a member of the steering committee for the Green Recovery project. I should say GRP there, but GRC, excellent. So these are the two projects are called the Green Recovery Project and the Recovery Park project. I'm going to compare them in terms of similarities and differences, in terms of vision and scale, in terms of community involvement and implementation and how that was done. And also I'm going to compare them in terms of outcomes, which are quite different, at least so far. And then I have some sort of tentative conclusions and questions. Now, I wasn't counting the number of slides that other people had. I have a few. I saw Will Allen one time do a presentation. Do you know who Will Allen is from Growing Power in Milwaukee? He did like 700 slides in an hour. So I'm not going to do that many, but I'm going to try and move at a pretty brisk clip here. So just to set the background for really both of these projects, some of the other presentations were on rural areas, and Detroit is an urban area, but there are actually some similar challenges in part because of the intense loss of population in a fairly short period of time. This is a cover story from the Wall Street Journal earlier this year. That was the headline, Detroit's population crashes, 25% plunge from 2000 to 2010 in the city of Detroit. And so that's a graphic from that article there on the left of Detroit's population, basically from mid-century to the present time, the 21st century. And on the right there is a photograph. Usually when you see these articles about Detroit, and there have been numbers of them in different places, they're accompanied by photographs like this. And you can just sort of drive around Detroit and take photos like this. In fact, this is one that I took in the neighborhood, one of the neighborhoods that I'm going to be talking about. So this is, again, just to put a kind of a, let's give you kind of a bird's eye view of the city of Detroit. This is a map put together not by me, but by Data Driven Detroit, which is a nonprofit that we have in the city of Detroit. They're a great resource. Their mission is to provide data to community organizations that need to use in a way that they can use it. And so my contribution to this map is to add those two green arrows, which show basically where the two projects that I'm going to be talking about, where they were based geographically. And they're both geographically focused efforts, and that's one of the reasons why I was interested in them and why I think this discussion fits into the business of this section. So what this map shows you is housing vacancy rates by census block group. So basically the darker areas are the ones with more vacancy. The second area that I'm talking about is outside the city of Detroit, so I have some specific slides there, but you see that arrow there at the bottom is below the city of Detroit. The Detroit River is there, and this is an area that's called Downriver. It's a sort of a suburban but industrial area, which is outside the city of Detroit, but shares many of the same issues. This is another slide showing percentage of housing with fire damage or in need of demolition or vacant, open, and dangerous. And again, you see in the one area in Detroit has one of the highest concentrations of these kinds of properties and spaces as were depicted in the photograph I showed earlier. This is the other area, so if you can imagine, if you went back the tail end there of Detroit, this sort of connects to the tail. In fact, this slide shows you one little section of Detroit that sort of descends down into this small suburban area. And these are almost like suburban industrial villages, really. In many ways, they're cut off from the larger Detroit metropolitan area. They have a long legacy of industrial development and production and current production. There's a Marathon oil plant in the Detroit 48217 area, which is expanding, actually. River Rouge has both the DTE power facility and U.S. Steel, and U.S. Steel is also located in the community of Ecorse there. And in terms of the statistics of these communities, and specifically River Rouge, which is the community where the effort that I'm going to talk about was centered, River Rouge has also lost a lot of population, lost 20% of its population in the last 10 years, and you can see that there's also a high percentage of vacant properties, and in terms of racial breakdown, River Rouge is about half African American and about less than half white at this point, and then a mixture of other groups. So I'm going to sort of flip back and forth between the two projects as I go along here, and I want to start with the rationale for Recovery Park because it connects directly to this problem facing Detroit as a whole, which is this population dive. And this is from the website of SHARE, Inc., which is the organization which was the spearheading organization for Recovery Park, talking about how the drug culture, the ravages of a drug culture coupled with the high incidence of crime have dramatically shrunk Detroit's population in the last 60 years, leaving the city with approximately 40 square miles of unproductive vacant land. Most parts of the city are littered with abandoned houses and buildings that have become havens for crime and drugs. And the focus on drugs here is not accidental. SHARE is a drug abuse treatment organization, actually a therapeutic community dating back to the late 60s. And one of the interesting things about these projects is how they represent a kind of a widening of focus for organizations that have traditionally been focused on individual treatment delivery. This is just a cut and paste from an article from the Wayne State University Law Review, and this is from 2008, around the same time these two projects were launched, just to give you an idea of the way in which urban farming entered into this discussion and became a kind of a sort of a beacon of hope for a lot of people in the city of Detroit, that this could be a means of both recovering vacant land, putting properties back in the tax rolls, and also employing people and addressing issues related to food access and some of the other things that have been touched on in the other presentations. So the two organizations that were behind the two efforts that I'm going to talk about are both nonprofits that have historically done more in the way of individual service delivery. On the one hand is the Guidance Center, which is a major major provider of services in the Downriver area. They're founded in 1958. I'm not going to read through the whole description of the Guidance Center, but it's there for you to read, because you can read it faster than I can. That's studies have shown that the eye can read much faster than the mouth can. So. And SHARE, Self-Help Addiction Rehabilitation, Inc., as I mentioned, was founded in 1969. So both of these agencies have historically focused on issues related to individual health and wellness, with the Guidance Center a lot of focus on mental health as well as substance abuse and also disabilities. SHARE has been much more narrowly focused on substance abuse, but has found their sort of mission expanding, especially if they've gone into the business of dealing with recovering or returning citizens, that is, individuals coming out of the prison system, and all the issues that they face. So one of the issues that I wanted to raise, and this is an issue that I'm sort of injecting into this discussion, is whether or not these two paradigms that I've been exposed to through my conversations with these organizations, but also through my own reading and my own research interests, are whether these are, I should say, really competing or converging paradigms, because I don't think they are conflicting. One is the recovery-oriented systems of care, or ROSC, a philosophy. How many people are familiar with that? Anybody heard of ROSC? This is really the sort of predominant mantra in treatment, substance abuse treatment these days, and it's primarily attributed to a guy named William White. But what's interesting about ROSC is that it really moves from the level of treatment, and it supports the contention that treatment is effective and treatment does work, but there's a limit to what treatment can do. And the acute care model, which is what, you know, the substance abuse treatment has traditionally been based on, an acute care medical care delivery model, really has some profound limitations when it comes to extended recovery in the long term. And so recovery-oriented systems of care really seeks to extend the thinking into the level of the community. Now, on the other hand, we're all probably familiar with the sort of what I call the building healthy communities paradigm. Here I use Jason Corburn's work as sort of representative of that. He's certainly not the only one that's talking about this, which is sort of moving back to a realignment of public health with urban planning, sort of thinking about the impact of the built environment, all the things that this section is interested in. And so this is actually more of a way of thinking, which is really from the top down. I mean, now we have a lot of talk about community engagement and community development, but the whole theory behind it is that the environment impacts us in ways that we don't think about. And if that's the case, it's hard to ask people or to get from people exactly how the environment is impacting them or what environments would be better for them if they're not even aware of how the environment is impacting them. So, I mean, it does raise a number of interesting questions. The thing I'm interested in is how these are sort of converging. So this is some comparison of the Green Recovery Project versus Recovery Park. There are these similarities about recovery taking place in the community, and also the use of agriculture or urban farming as a sort of a route to recovery for both individuals and for the environment. Both had many partners and few funders, and a limited amount of funding. In the case of GRP, the funding has now run out, and Recovery Park is still very much kind of in a planning phase. And there are a lot of differences in terms of scale and also in terms of the host communities. As I've talked about, Detroit, these are some of the partners that were involved in Recovery Park. These are some of the partners involved with the Green Recovery Project. Most of these are not providing funding. Most of these were funders which were sort of supporting the work or providing input, but were not supporting it in a material way. The Green Recovery Project, the goals and mission was ambitious, but yet was, in a sense, modest and limited. So you can see 3 years, three cities, three gardens, a goal of involving people with disabilities and also providing gardens access to fresh locally grown produce. This is the target area for the Green Recovery Project in the communities in Downriver. And this shows you some of the demographics in terms of unemployment and poverty rates. This is a kind of a ground truthing exercise that some of the people from the Green Recovery Project did to look at the fresh produce stores which were available in the community. And so a lot of what they saw is not unfamiliar, similar to what has been reported in some of the other papers here today. Places that advertised having fresh vegetables did not necessarily have them. These are some of the sites of the existing and proposed gardens. This is the main garden, the first one was produced, so that shows the aerial view. This is just the plan of the garden. Just again to show you, the plans are very specific, but at the same time modest in terms of size and scale. So the results were also modest, but they were measurable. So there was a certain amount of garden space that was produced, a certain number of plants, workshops were done, produce was produced and consumed. Now in the case of Recovery Park, it had this really sweeping vision, sweeping ambitious vision of how we're going to move from teaching people about individual responsibility to strengthening the fabric of communities and rebuilding communities through urban agriculture. This is the demographics of that target area. You can see it's a majority African-American area, higher rate of unemployment, higher rate of poverty, although similar rate of education. This is, again, to show you the difference in scale. This is inside the city of Detroit, and those are some of the footprint. That's the footprint for the Recovery Park Project. They produced a lot of plans for fish farms, sculpture garden, educational training programs, an equestrian facility, deconstruction and repurposing programs for existing buildings or abandoned buildings. And a lot of these plans are done by the University of Detroit Mercy Collaborative Design Center, who's really a kind of a pioneer and innovator in this community engaged process. But as yet, at this point, there's really not much, if any, visible impact on the area. And these are four of the sites that were proposed in the plans for Recovery Park to be turned into agricultural sites to renovate the Shane Ferry Market. And to turn this into the school, this abandoned school up there, into a source of both training and of equipment for urban agriculture. So the issue with Recovery Park is a visionary narrative, but at the same time, a really, to borrow the words of Donald Rumsfeld, a long, hard slog in terms of the process of implementing. And what they faced is something which should have been foreseen, and maybe to some extent was foreseen, but the sense among people in the neighborhood that there was a kind of a hidden agenda behind this effort. And so this is a quote from a newspaper article from August of this year, and the suspicions that were found around the neighborhood. One neighbor referred to it as a plantation. So again, this is predominantly poor African-American community. This is a woman that I interviewed because I've been doing ethnographic interviews in the area for the last couple months. And this highlights, again, the problem of the hidden agenda. And so I just want to, you know, focus on those words in red there. You bring in all these other things, these other people, everything is like up here at this level, and we still down here. So eventually, the sense was, we going to be weeded out, that the people that are on the ground, all these big plans can't possibly include them. And so the questions and the conclusions that I had to do really with these problematic notions of community. I hear a lot of talk about community and community engagement, but oftentimes community is not conceptually clarified. It's not very clear. What's meant by community can vary depending on who's using the term or who's talking about it. And so this is something that needs to be addressed in these kinds of projects. Also, the problems posed by community-level interventions, that there are perils in over-promising what you're going to deliver. Impacts are diffuse and it can be difficult to measure. And these sort of larger questions about whether or not, my big question for all this discussion is whether or not these healthy communities interventions would really be necessary if we had a healthy public sector and a functioning government, both the local and the federal level. Okay, so that's about, I just about got through it in the right amount of time. These are some of the people that I must acknowledge. And those are my children who are probably trick-or-treating without me right about now. So thank you very much.